Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a study by the apartment search website Rent Cafe finds that more wealthy Americans are choosing to rent living spaces instead of buying them. The study's writer, Alexandra Siuntu, collected information from the U.S. Census Bureau. She found that the number of U.S. households earning at least $150,000 a year that chose to rent increased 175% between 2007 and 2017. This new kind of renter goes against the idea that Americans rent mostly because they do not have enough money to buy a home. Siuntu told VOA by email, "Lifestyle plays an important part in their decision to rent." Business and technology centers like San Francisco, California, and Seattle, Washington, have the highest numbers of wealthy renters. In San Francisco, the number of renters grew from 21,000 in 2007 to 71,400 in 2017. That is an increase of 240%. The number of wealthy buyers increased by 56%, from 40,100 in 2007 to 62,400 in 2017. Siuntu says that, with the rise in housing prices, it seems like a better decision to rent than to buy. She added, "In San Francisco, for example, $200,000 buys you just 260 square feet. It's understandable why top earners give renting a serious try before deciding whether to invest in a property or not." In San Francisco and New York City, wealthy renters outnumber wealthy buyers. There are more high-earning renters, about 250,000 in New York City, than anywhere else in the country. But Siuntu notes that the interest in renting does not mean wealthy Americans are rejecting homeownership. Between 2007 and 2017, Seattle gained 13,400 more wealthy homeowners than it did high-income renters. Cities like Chicago and Denver also saw thousands more wealthy homeowners move in than wealthy renters during that 10-year period.
North Korea is not known for welcoming popular culture. In fact, North Korean leaders have historically sought to keep Western cultural influences out of the nation's communist society. North Korea remains one of the most closed nations in the world. People who openly criticize North Korea's government or leadership can be seen as a threat and face severe punishment. Cultural changes have traditionally come very slowly. Watching television programming or listening to music from South Korea is illegal. Government restrictions also make it impossible for most North Koreans to travel abroad or to freely experience foreign movies or books. But under current leader Kim Jong-un, North Korea appears to be taking steps toward its own pop culture revolution. Clear evidence of this change can be seen in music, television, film, and fashion. The change is described in a report by the Associated Press's bureau chief in Pyongyang, Eric Talmadge. The changes could be evidence that Kim's government is realizing that despite heavy restrictions, North Koreans are still experiencing foreign pop influences. It could be an attempt by Kim's government to try to keep up culturally with South Korea and the rest of the world. One example is a North Korean female pop group that has become hugely popular in the country and even has fans abroad. The group, called Moranbang, is also a known personal favorite of Kim Jong-un. The women perform in colorful, stylish clothing that shows off their bodies in a way not commonly seen before in North Korea. Another change is evident in North Korea's footwear industry. Factories are busy producing shoes designed to look like Air Jordans or other popular shoes being sold in other parts of the world. The large Yuwon Shoe Factory in Pyongyang shows off the latest creations in a colorful setting that looks similar to many Western showrooms. The collection includes shoes for all kinds of sports, including running, volleyball, soccer, and table tennis. Kim Kyung-hee works at the factory. She told the AP the operation is aimed at producing what the North Korean people want. In general, many North Korean goods are now being presented to the public in Western-style packaging designed to be more appealing. Changes have also happened on North Korean television. The country's programs still include a lot of propaganda and documentaries with high praise for North Korean leaders. But there is improved production values. The acting seems more realistic and emotional, and the stories more entertaining. The sets and clothing meet a much higher level of quality than in previous projects. One of the most watched television shows in the country currently is The Wild Ginseng Gatherers of the Imjin War. It is a historical series set in the late 16th century, when Korea was struggling against Japanese invaders. I'm Brian Lin.
Water is a necessity of life. Rain, especially, helps plants grow and stay green. But too much rain, especially in cities, can lead to flooding. That can cause waste water systems, like sewers, to overflow and send pollutants into rivers and other waterways. To fight the problem, several cities in the United States are starting programs like rooftop gardens. A team at the University of the District of Columbia in the nation's capital has created a garden on the top of one school building. The garden holds many kinds of plants to help absorb rainwater and grow food at the same time. Architect David Bell has designed 5 green roofs for the university. He says he is excited about the project because it meant doing something more than just dealing with storm water management.
They took advantage of a resource above the city that you see all over, where you have these flat roofs that aren't doing anything, and really made it something that was about urban agriculture.
Rainwater is collected in large containers and sent through a system that waters the rooftop garden. The roof is filled with green life that appeals to insects. In cities, you don't have that many spaces to choose from, and so rooftops are just unused space, says Caitlin Arlotta. She is a student in the school's urban agriculture program. The project is part of a research program to see which plants do well on rooftops. The researchers are looking at plants including strawberries, tomatoes, and sweet potatoes. The university also has other green spaces. We also have our own farm experiments, Arlotta said. Within each of those growing systems, we want to be able to tell people which sorts of these crops grow the best. One goal of the program is food justice, or, in Arlotta's words, bringing fresh food into cities where you wouldn't necessarily have that access. And that includes produce that might be more recognizable to immigrant members of the community. Sandy Farber Bandier helps run UDC's Master Gardener program. It seeks to improve cities and make them beautiful by training people to become master gardeners. She says she's been surprised by the garden's output.
My biggest surprise was that we produced 4,250 pounds of produce the first year and was able to disseminate that to people in need.
She likes being able to show people who live in D.C. and others beyond the nation's capital what and how food can be grown on a rooftop. I'm Susan Shand.
Scientists have discovered the oldest fossil evidence of organism motility, or the ability of an organism to move independently. The discovery shows that development of motility began more than 2 billion years ago. The fossils were found in Gabon, in rock called shale. Researchers described them as tube-like structures up to 170 millimeters long. They say the structures may have been created when the organisms moved through soft, wet dirt in search of food or a better environment. The researchers also said the organisms might have been moving together as a group. The organisms remain a mystery, as the fossils are a record only of their movement. The researchers said the fossils dated back to a time when Earth was rich with oxygen. These conditions permitted simple life forms to develop more complexity. Life on Earth started with single-celled bacteria about 4 billion years ago. The earliest life forms could not move under their own power. The Gabon fossils, dated to the Paleo-Proterozoic era, are about 1.5 billion years older than the previous earliest evidence of organism motility. Abderrazak El Albani, a scientist with the University of Poitiers in France, led the team in Gabon. The shale deposit there has proven to be a treasure for the study of ancient life. Several years ago, Albani and his team discovered it held the oldest fossils known of multicellular animals. What matters here is their astonishing complexity and diversity in shape and size, and likely in terms of metabolic, developmental, and behavioral patterns, including the just-discovered earliest evidence of motility, at least for certain among them, Albani said. The first vertebrates, or animals with backbones, appeared about 525 million years ago. Dinosaurs came about 230 million years ago, and human-like species developed about 300,000 years ago. Scientists believe this early time in motility may have faced a setback soon after the Paleo-Proterozoic era, about the time of the Gabon fossils. The Earth saw a considerable loss of atmospheric oxygen at that time. The research was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 2 years of a bitter, bloody civil war started to show their effects on both the Confederate States of the South and the Union States of the North. Both sides began to feel the pressure of the costly struggle. The South, however, felt the pressure more severely because it was weaker in troop strength and industrial strength. Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles discuss the early summer of 1863 in the American Civil War.
In 1863, the Confederate States were becoming short of supplies. Food and guns were difficult to find to keep the Confederate armies in the field. Men were also needed. More and more men. There seemed to be no end to the demand for men to fill the places left empty by dead and wounded soldiers. Many in the South were heavy of heart, and hope among them slowly started to sink. The war was tiring. Its suffering was more than they could bear. And the situation in the West made matters worse. Union armies were on the move in the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. Their successes were becoming a serious threat. They might soon win control of the whole Mississippi River. This would split the states of the Confederacy and might end its very existence. Something was needed to raise up the spirits of the South, to break the pressure of Union armies. General Robert E. Lee believed that he had the answer, an invasion of the North. This, he felt, would throw fear into the people of the North and weaken the Union war effort. Lee had organized an army of 75,000 men at Fredericksburg, Virginia, halfway between Washington and Richmond. Lee began moving his men June 3rd. They marched northwest into the Shenandoah Valley. The valley led north to the Potomac River. Across the river was the narrow neck of western Maryland, then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the target. Its rich farmland produced plenty of food, enough to feed Lee's hungry army for the summer. Standing in the way of Lee's army was a small Union force at Winchester in Northern Virginia. There were only 7,000 Union soldiers, and they had no idea that the Confederate army was nearby. The Confederates easily defeated them. More than half of the Union troops were captured. The others fled. Now, there was nothing to stop Lee from marching into Pennsylvania. The huge Army of the Potomac was behind him, near Washington. The Union commander, General Hooker, had to keep the army between Lee and Washington to prevent the Confederates from seizing the national capital. Lee's army crossed western Maryland and entered Pennsylvania. His soldiers found the Pennsylvania countryside very different from Virginia's. Virginia had been a battleground for 2 years, and the land showed it. Many of its farms had been destroyed. Its stores were empty. Pennsylvania had not been touched by the war. Its big farms were rich. Its towns and villages were full of food and goods of all kinds. The hungry, poorly clothed soldiers could not believe their eyes. This was the land of the enemy, they cried, and they could take whatever they wished. But General Lee said no. He said supplies could be taken only by Confederate supply officers. And, he said, they must pay in Confederate money for everything they took.
Lee did not want to anger these people in Pennsylvania. Many of them did not support the Union war effort. Some of the rich farmers said openly that they did not care who won the war. They said they only wanted to be left alone. Lee was sure that many in the North felt the same way. There had been signs that people were growing tired of the war. Coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania had shown their feelings toward the war a few months earlier. They rose up against a new law drafting men into the Union Army. The miners did not want to fight. They refused to join the army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to the mining areas to put down the riots.
Farmers in nearby Ohio also rebelled against the draft law. They refused to be drafted. Instead, they took guns and battled soldiers who came to arrest them. Feelings against the war were growing stronger, not only in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but also in several other farm states of the North. These areas saw a growing support for a peace party, a political party opposed to the war. Leaders of this movement were Democrats called Copperheads. They got this name because they wore on their coats a copper penny with the head of an Indian.
The chief Copperhead was a former Ohio congressman. His name was Clement Vallandigham. As a member of Congress, Vallandigham criticized the war and the Republicans. He told them, The war for the Union is, in your hands, a most bloody and costly failure. War for the Union was abandoned, and war for the Negro was openly begun with stronger effort than before. With what success? Vallandigham asked. Let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer. Vallandigham said he wanted peace, and he wanted it immediately. He offered a simple program. Stop the fighting. Make a ceasefire. And let some friendly foreign nation negotiate peace between North and South.
After he lost his seat in Congress, Vallandigham opened a campaign to become governor of Ohio. He traveled all across the state, speaking out against the war. He said Republicans did not want peace. He said they wanted to fight until every black man was free. The Union military commander for Ohio was General Ambrose Burnside, a former commander of the Army of the Potomac. After losing the Battle of Fredericksburg, Lincoln removed Burnside as Army commander and sent him to Ohio. Burnside was worried. Too many people in Ohio opposed the war. He believed that much of what was being said and done in Ohio was close to the crime of treason.
Burnside announced several new measures to quiet the opponents of the war. One of these orders limited the right of citizens to criticize government military policy. Another declared that statements of support for the enemy would be punished as treason. Vallandigham refused to recognize Burnside's right to give such orders to civilians. On May 1st, he made a campaign speech to a big crowd at Mount Vernon, Ohio. He denounced Burnside's orders and spoke of the president as King Lincoln. Vallandigham claimed that Lincoln was using the war to become a dictator. He said Lincoln did not want peace, that the president had rejected peace offers from the South. Once again, he said the war was not a struggle for the Union, but a fight to free the slaves of the South. And he said, men of Ohio, who let themselves be drafted into the Union Army, were no better than slaves themselves.
Burnside had sent several Army officers to listen to the speech. When they reported what Vallandigham said, Burnside ordered his arrest. Without question, the man had violated the general's orders. Late the next night, soldiers went to Vallandigham's home in Dayton. They knocked on the door and said they had come to arrest him. Vallandigham called for help and refused to let the soldiers enter. They broke down the door, seized him, and took him to a military prison in Cincinnati. A few days later, Vallandigham went on trial before a military court in Cincinnati. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.